Hi there. A bit of a somber reason that we're coming to you on this podcast that we didn't have scheduled, but it's Sunday night, or Sunday, it's New Year's Day night. It feels like a Sunday night, but it's Wednesday night. And we learned today of David Stern's passing. And I can't imagine anybody to talk to about this who could be better than Jackie McMullen, who has covered the NBA for a long time, pretty much almost the whole time, just a few years after David Stern, or right about the same time David Stern became the commissioner, Jackie, right? Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Do you remember when you met David Stern?
I do. That is very memorable. The details surrounding it are hazy because, as people can probably guess by what you just told them, I'm kind of old. But sometime in the
just
early
kind of.
80s, probably like 85, maybe 86, there was this tradition, and please forgive me for not remembering it properly. It was either the Celtics or the NBA itself used to, this is no lie, it's so funny now because this would never happen now. They had a preseason tennis tournament. And I remember you played doubles, and my partner was Chris Ford of the Celtics. He was at that time, I think, an assistant coach. Or was he still playing? This is what I mean. It's all a little fuzzy to me. So they asked me, do you play tennis? And I said, well, I do. And they said, do you want to go to this thing? And I was a new NBA writer. I was going to be, you know, the 11th man in. We still had the legend Bob Ryan working. I was working at the Boston Globe. And we had a chorus of people that covered the Celtics. But I was going to get to be the 10th person in. I was going to get to be involved a little bit. So they invited me to this tennis event, and I think it was in New York, so maybe it was an NBA thing, and probably someone who's listening can set me straight. But I was nervous, of course, first of all, because I'm not a great tennis player. I hadn't played tennis in a while, and what do I wear? I sound like the Grinch, but what do I wear? And anyway, so I was playing with Chris, who I knew a little bit, and he's so great, and he was trying to make me comfortable. And so we're playing, and I remember I went back, and I chased down a ball. You know, we were both at the net. Chris was like, we're just going to stay at the net the whole time. And they lobbed the ball overhead, and, you know, I was young. I was in my 20s. I was in good shape. I was still playing basketball a few nights a week. So I ran back, and I hit this lob, and I hit it so darn hard. It went, like, completely not over just the other side, but, like, out of the court. I mean, it was so embarrassing. And I remember there was ivy on the – fences. So it was a very nice tennis club, wherever it was. And all of a sudden I hear this voice, and it's this guy, and he's got this hat on, like a Gilligan's Island hat. And I hear this, Stern here, you might not want to hit it so hard next time. And I was like, oh no, this is the commissioner of the NBA. And I just lobbed this thing like into outer space. And so I just always remember it because what he was trying to do was to lighten, you know, break the tension, right? I was this young writer that everybody's looking at, the only woman there. And that was his way of breaking the tension. And I just remember he was a very good tennis player, by the way, played a lot of tennis during his time. So anyway, that was the first time I met him. And I met him, of course, and dealt with him many, many more times after that. And sometimes they were very pleasant, and sometimes they weren't. As you know, Brian, he was an incredible force of nature.
Yes.
And I was on the wrong end of that sometimes. And I remember one time he hauled me into his office in New York, and I thought he was bringing me in there like to tell me something great, like a scoop. And he's like, what happened to you? You used to be nice. And I'm like, what, seriously? I'm here in your office for this? He's like, yeah, you used to be nice. I said, well, you're never nice, because he wasn't, you know? And but he was just, it was his way of just letting me know I'm watching you. I think I had written something critical of the league or critical of a team. And he was just letting me know he was paying attention. He was always paying attention.
That's true. He had a way he could wither you with a sentence.
Sometimes a word.
Yeah, I met him in 2003 at the draft lottery, the LeBron James draft lottery, which was at the studios in Secaucus, New Jersey, in the middle of the swamp. And that night, the Cavs had won the lottery, and the Knicks did not. And shortly after the lottery was over, the Cavs were having a teleconference to discuss the victory. And I don't even know. I mean, I had a cell phone at the time, but I had to go into like the NBA offices to listen to the teleconference. And on my way out, I ran into David Stern, like in the back offices, and I introduced myself to him and with the Akron Beacon Journal. And he said, this will show everybody to think that that I fix lotteries. Nobody wanted him to go to Cleveland. Only people wanted to go to Cleveland were you people. And, you know, he was charming about it, but it was sort of his way of,
You bet.
You know, yeah. I didn't have as many interactions with him as you did, but,
well, here's my favorite. You want to hear my favorite interaction with David Stern? So it's 1995. There's a lockout and they're having these meetings in New York. You know, they're trying to, you know, rectify this because this is not what the NBA does. That was the first lockout in history. I was wasn't a young reporter anymore, but I was just starting to do more television. And even though I was still working at the Boston Globe, I was doing freelance stuff for ESPN. They had me do a little something. I'm embarrassed. Don't look it up. I'm not even going to tell the name of it. A little weekly NBA report. Anyway, somehow someone decided I should be at the lockout at this New York courthouse live. We should do a live report from this courthouse in New York. And so I'm like, okay, sure. So I don't think the lockout had ended because that ended on a vote. I think they were having meetings or whatever. But anyway, Stern was there and I'm standing up to do this live shot and they've got me, you know, positioned in the hallway. So it looks very regal and very official. And I go to do the stand up and I'm, you know, got my mic and I'm looking at the camera and all of a sudden Stern walks out and I'm doing this live shot. And he's standing behind the camera like a 7-year-old with his fingers in his ears, wiggling and making faces at me and trying to make me laugh on live television. And that's one of my favorite memories because it was so Stern. He had moments like this. People that knew him well saw these moments all the time. But he was testing me. He was challenging me. That's what he always was doing with people, right? He was always challenging you, making you a little bit uncomfortable and seeing how you would react. Tests, little tests all the way through. Remember, I was very young when I first met him. I was in my 20s and all the way up to my 50s. This guy who I've known forever and got to like very much, even though there were times that he infuriated me and I'm sure I infuriated him. But these little tests, they never stopped. They never did.
Yeah, you know, you listen to people tell stories about him, the broad spectrum where he could absolutely shoot daggers, but on the other hand, have extreme kindness. I mean, in 2008, I got very sick and I was in the hospital for a few months over the summer. And the season opener that year was the Cavs at the Celtics. The Celtics got their rings that night. And I made it. I was able to recover enough to make the season opener, which I didn't tell anybody, but it was very important to me to make. And before the game, I was sitting in the Celtics press room, you know, that room, Jackie, that's
the Will McDonough press room.
God just sitting there writing, you know, before the game, an hour before the game or so. And I was just minding my own business, writing in my computer, and I felt this hand on my shoulder, and I turned around. It was David Stern. And he said, I'm so glad to see you here. I wasn't sure we were going to have you back. And so that was very meaningful to me that he saw, you know, he was there to give the rings. And so the fact that he came to sought me out was very meaningful. Then 2 years later, the summer that LeBron signed with the Heat, the Cavs were, of course, very upset about it. Basically, believed that the Heat were tampering. Still happening to this day. As a matter of fact, when a team loses a free agent, there's complaints about tampering. So it wasn't unusual for it to happen. And I had written kind of extensively about it. And David Stern, we was at the Board of Governors meeting in a couple of days, maybe 3-4 days after the decision. And I had done a lot of reporting about how the Cavs were upset. And we were ready to go into the press conference, and he walked in before he even got to the podium, and he saw me. He just pointed at me and said, you are causing a lot of problems right now. And could be at both ends of it. That's
Yeah, but that meant you were doing your job. It just meant you were doing your job.
Of course,
you know,
of course.
He was the one thing that he was without fail was a fierce, fierce advocate for women. He just wouldn't stand for any impropriety regarding women. He also, as we can see by the decisions he made in the front office of the NBA and the amount of people that he promoted and held up through his tenure as commissioner. But, you know, in the 90s, maybe it was later. Again, my memory's fuzzy, but I had written a column that was very, very critical of a player who I'm not going to name only because after all these years, we finally buried the hatchet. And every time I bring up this story, it causes him problems. So I'm not going to name him anymore. And this story, anyway, I wrote a story. It was very critical of him. Very, very upset. Of course, I showed up. It was the team that it was a visiting team in Boston that came to play. And he confronted me in the locker room. They're all big. They're all strong. They're all a little scary when they're angry at you 2 inches from your face. He had to be separated by his teammates. It was a very unnerving experience for me. I held up pretty well until I walked outside of the locker room, and then my legs went weak. It was a very scary moment for me. It was this guy was right in my face. And, you know, at the time, I was too unnerved to wonder, like, well, would he have done that if I was a guy? I don't know. I wasn't even thinking about any of that. I didn't report it. I didn't tell anybody. Certainly enough people witnessed it. I got a call the next day. Now, we don't have cell phones then. There's no caller ID. I just pick up my phone. Stern here. All right, McMullen, what happened? And I said, how did you even know about it? Seriously? You know, of course he knows everything. And I tell him, and he said, you will get a phone call within an hour, an apology from this player. And I sure did. I sure did.
Mm. Yeah, he, you know, the way I was thinking about it is, you know, he wasn't – the NBA doesn't grow without Bird and Magic. It doesn't grow without Jordan. It doesn't grow without LeBron. They are the engines that drive the growth of the NBA. But David Stern was the pilot. You know, it's hard to place in a game that's played by great athletes. It's hard to be able to understand where an executive would rank. But he, at the same time, he so drove the game, so drove the growth of the international part of the game. You know, the Dream Team and his pushing for that, and the result that it had. The NBA, you know, moving into the Chinese market, the Asian markets. But also, just as revolutionary was him supporting the WNBA, right, Jack?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of his great, great moments, in my opinion. But see, the thing that – the mistake people make, I think, Brian, is when they look at David Stern, they say, oh, well, let's start his influence starts in 1984. No, way before that, way before that. In the 60s – he was working for the law firm that represented the NBA. It's a whole bunch of long names. I'm going to get them wrong, so I'm not even going to
try. Proskauer Rose.
Getz and somebody else, yeah. Anyway, he was a young lawyer in that firm. And one of the cases that he got very early on in his tenure there was Connie Hawkins. Connie Hawkins was trying to be reinstated into the NBA. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Connie Hawkins, he was a very young, talented New York City player who was – in his mind, falsely accused of point shaving. He never got to play a game in college because of it and was blackballed from the NBA because these people in New York City decided he had conspired to shave points because he had a relationship with a known fixer. And it was a case that once this very young lawyer named David Stern started looking into it, in his mind, smacked of unfairness. And he thought had racial, even had racial overtones to it. And he went to the NBA. Now, this guy's a young lawyer going to the NBA and saying, you've got to fix this. This guy belongs in the NBA. I don't know what you guys are doing here, but I've reviewed these documents. You need to get this guy back into the NBA. So that's how far back David Stern's influence in the league goes. And again, also a fierce advocate, as you know, for African Americans. In 1979, Magic Johnson, everybody knows he was drafted as the number one pick, but probably what a lot of people don't know is, again, how antiquated the NBA was at that time. The Chicago Bulls and Los Angeles Lakers, this is no lie, flipped a coin to see who got to get the number one pick. This coin flip was done in New York City. So you had Bill Sharman in the Lakers in LA. You had, I think it was probably Rod Thorne and the Bulls in Chicago. And there was a little squawk box that everybody was listening on, a three-way squawk box, one in New York, one in, so the commissioner's O'Brien at this point.
Like a conference call.
Right, like a conference call, but it's this little box. It was actually a little, they called it a squawk box. And the legal counsel for the NBA in 1979 was David Stern, who presided over this coin flip. And by the way, the Chicago Bulls fans all voted that the Bulls should choose heads. So the Bulls chose heads, and the coin came up tails, and Magic Johnson became a Laker, and the Bulls got David Greenwood. So again, David Stern woven into the fabric of this league, you know? I mean, and the WNBA for him was a labor of love. It was never a question of if he was going to do a women's league, only when. It was very, very important to him. As you know, it had some early success and then waned a little bit, and people refused to cover it. There was you know, financial issues. They didn't pay the players a lot of money. And people would come to him and say, you know, maybe not. And he would say, absolutely not. Go back and look at the NBA, you know, on tape delay in 1980, the finals. It takes time. I will not let these women down. And I would think we can all agree that he stayed true to that right up to his final moments of his life.
Hey, while Jackie and I are here talking about David Stern, I'd like to mention that you should listen to Jeremy Schapp, who is going to be giving a remembrance of David J. Stern on the ESPN Daily podcast that publishes on Thursday. You should be checking that out every day. Anyway, it's tremendous content from the best of ESPN that we have. But definitely listen to Jeremy Schapp, who did a terrific essay for SportsCenter. And we'll have more on the ESPN Daily podcast. He definitely collected power. That was very important to him. And one of the ways he collected power was when he sometimes basically put owners into position. He made deals for teams. When he first came in, you know, some of the teams were failing and were in danger of going out of business. And so it was a matter of just saving them. But, you know, he in a lot of situations where he would basically put an owner in position. He would make him a deal. He maybe would stretch the rules or kick the ball into the fairway or whatever. And that owner would then basically be beholden to him. And they got to the point where he had this voting block. And, you know, and in a lot of ways that could have been, bad for the NBA. It could have held the NBA back. One man having too much power. Because while the owners technically were his bosses, because of the nature of how he made it a priority to sort of have, you know, a leverage point on them or you know, have their undying support. But he used it to be progressive. He pushed the league forward. When the large portions of the league weren't in favor of something, but he wanted it to be done, he would squeeze it through. He would, get on the phone and work it and make sure that when there was a vote, it went his way. But it was in a progressive way to grow the league. And, in that way, he's remembered at times where people would say would be abuses of power. Some people still are. I've never gotten over the Chris Paul.
Understandably, right?
I used to try to defend him on that because he was the acting
He
was the owner, but he, you know, in theory, he had the mandate of the other teams. So the Hornets at the time were owned by the other 29 teams. They were sort of nationalized. Right. And the concept was that he didn't, you know, the other teams didn't favor the Lakers getting Chris Paul, and therefore it didn't happen. And I sort of said, you know, look, he was just, you know, doing the bidding of his bosses. And I had somebody in the league office tell me, Brian, I appreciate you saying, I said it on TV a couple of times over the years because I appreciate you saying that. But I happened to be standing next to David when we heard the trade come in, and he said, hell no, Chris Paul is not getting traded to the Lakers. He didn't wait for any mandate from his the other owners. He basically made the decision in that moment.
Right.
So in that case, you know, there were times where there may have been times where he might have had too much power. But I think on balance, he used that power for the good of the league.
Right. No, I agree. But there were times that you know, for instance, the sort of ongoing battle with the Spurs, for instance. Remember, it's so funny to look back now on load management, right? That's really what we were talking about. As usual, Popovich was way ahead of the curve on that, didn't bring his guys. And I think it was, in Stern's mind, he didn't like it, but it was also, I think, a personal affront. You know, they didn't notify him ahead of time.
Right, right.
You know, that was more is that. And he was a very prideful man, and he did not like to be crossed. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I've met a lot of amazing people in my life, but he is the smartest person I have ever met, Brian. He had an answer for everything. Now, the answer might not have always been correct, but God forbid you challenge him, which we all have done from time to time. He was just, he had the sharpest, sharpest mind and a very, very sharp edge to him as well, which I think he very freely acknowledged throughout his, you know, his tenure as the commissioner. He had some blind spots. You know, you talk about the blocks, the people that supported him. I don't know this for a fact, but you've got to believe that Donald Sterling was one of them, because why else would he have looked the other way the way he did?
Yeah, I know. That's
George
a black
Shin,
mark.
George Shin also. So, yeah. You know, he's nobody's perfect, of course. But I just, what I liked about him was there were, when things mattered to him, like supporting women and being fair to women, and whether it was a woman reporter or these WNBA players, or whether it was being fair to African Americans and making sure he was so fiercely supportive. And the other example I always give is Magic. Listen, Magic Johnson was HIV positive. None of us understood it. In fact, even Irvin himself, when he right before he was about to go on stage to tell everybody, this is what's happened to me, he turned to Lon, and Lon Rosen, his agent, and Lon said to him, do you know what you're going to say? He said, you know what, Lon, I'm just going to tell them I have AIDS. And Lon said to him, Irvin, you don't have AIDS. You have the virus that causes AIDS.
I was in seventh grade or something like that.
Right, of course. So none of us understood the severity of this. And David Stern was up late at night calling medical experts all over the world to try to stay one step ahead so he could understand this crisis that he was dealing with. And of course, you know, when Irvin retired the first time and then came back and retired the second time and then, you know, wanted to come back. When he wanted to come back that first time, that's when everybody started saying, well, wait a minute, I don't know about
this. Well, the All-Star game, Jackie, right?
Right, right.
He came to play in the All-Star game.
Right. But that was accepted because that didn't count. No one was going to, you know, no one was going to play too hard. That was sort of thing. This is a one-time thing. We'll, and, you know, then it was the dream team. But then when he wanted to come back following that, Brian, that's when you started to hear the complaints. Wait a minute. I don't want to risk my life. There were owners saying, hey, I am not in support of this. I don't want to do this. And
right.
And what David Stern told him was, all right, listen, I'm just going to tell you right now. If we don't do this, first of all, you can expect a lawsuit. And do we need that kind of bad publicity that we won't let an HIV person? And then the second thing, and this was the hammer. This was the hammer David Stern used. And I don't think this has been reported very widely was this. Okay, if you're not going to let him in, then we're going to have mandatory HIV testing for everybody in the NBA. And are you all sure that you don't have anybody on your roster that's HIV positive? Because I'm not sure. And this is the kind of, and he was going to do the right thing by Irvin, not because he loved Irvin Johnson, because he did, but because it was the right thing to do. And those were the moments when I admired him the most, when even though there was, I mean, his legacy was at stake there. Imagine if that had gone badly. If that had gone wrong. And remember, we know now all about HIV, that it's treatable, that you can live a full life with it, that you can't get it from exchanging blood or exchanging, you know, saliva or blood. If you know, all these things, all these scary things that back then in that climate, because I lived it, everyone thought, well, if I get near him, I'm not going to hug him. I might get AIDS. Well, he didn't even have AIDS. But but David Stern was one step ahead, and he was telling everybody, I'm going to fight this fight. And if you aren't willing to, I'm warning you, these are the things that could happen. And, you know, I mean, Magic Johnson told me flat out, he gave me my life back. He saved my life. That's what Irvin told me. And I believe it.
Yeah. You know, Adrian Wojnarowski wrote a brilliant piece, in my opinion, that was sort of his obit, an obit column that ran on ESPN Tonight. And I really encourage you to go read it because Woj handles it well, talking about how he could be fiery and soft and powerful and giving all in the same. Yeah. He talks about a quote from the All-Star game leading up to the lockout in 2011, where he met with the All-Stars and basically threatened them. And I remember this quote vividly, and it was one of the first things I thought of when he passed away. And Woj had it right in the story, was he told the players, you know, I've buried a lot of bodies. He said there's a lot of bodies buried in this league. I know because I buried them. And so you wonder, Jackie, what secrets he took to his grave. Can you imagine some of the things that he adjudicated, that he handled, that he did to protect the league? Or I mean,
so many. And you know, the reason he shared some of those details I just shared with you, which was when I did the book When the Game Was Ours, which. I interviewed David extensively for that book, and that's the first time he discussed a lot of this stuff about Irvin and HIV, because by then it was an accepted thing. People, you know, Irvin was doing well. There was no trace of HIV in his system, although, of course, he's still on his medication because, you know, you should never stop taking your medication just because there's no trace of it, which Irvin also talks about. But all of these things, you know, they had been settled, if you will. So it was okay to share some of the concern and the trepidation and the terror that players were feeling, coaches, GMs. You know, there was a game where he got cut against Cleveland, and players were in the huddle saying to Lenny Wilkins, I don't know if I want to go back out there. I mean, this was a very real thing. It's hard to imagine now, but Stern was at the very middle of that, and his legacy was on the line as well as Irvin's. But he, in this particular case, just didn't care.
I just remember when the Kings were about to move to Seattle. It was all lined up.
Right. That's
2014
right.
Or so. I was living in New York at the time, and I had been assigned to cover that story for ESPN. And I went to a meeting. The owners had a little like a meeting to discuss it at the St. Regis Hotel, where they hold all their big meetings in New York. And
right.
The group from Seattle came in, and the group from Sacramento didn't even know who the owner was going to be. I mean, it was. I mean, they were buying the team from the Leafs. They were sort of throwing together an ownership bid at the last minute, and at the literally minutes before the press conference, they were rearranging chairs to decide who was going to be the front man. It ended up being Vivek Ranadive.
Right.
And and
Virginia Beach was in that for a while. Remember, they were talking about Virginia Beach.
It was just the Seattle people had Steve Ballmer. And they had Chris Hansen, who was as buttoned up as you possibly could be.
Right.
They had the arena. They had everything lined up. The better market. You know, they had an agreement to buy the team. Everything was done. The ball was at the 1 yard line. And I remember leaving this, and I was a very, very high ranking NBA executive, not David Stern, who I ran into on the street right over there at Fifth Avenue, and they said to me. David doesn't want him to move. And in that moment, like, I mean, they named the street leading up to the new arena in Sacramento, David J. Stern Way. And I said they should have named the whole arena after him, because he didn't want the Kings to move to Seattle. He, you know, and I never understood this. And I, you know, I'm from Cleveland area. I have a soft spot for small markets, for sure. David Stern, you know, refused to let the New Orleans Pelicans be sold and moved. He only wanted them to be sold to stay in New Orleans. He saved basketball in New Orleans. You know, they could have stayed in Oklahoma City. And I happened to be there the night George Shinn, I was in Oklahoma City the night George Shinn announced he was moving the team, he was going to take the team after the hurricane, he was going to take them back to New Orleans full time. And, you know, he said that God told him in church to move him back. But I know that it was David Stern who told him to move him back. And
right.
and then when Shinn couldn't afford the team anymore and basically went broke, he could have sold it to Larry Ellison and they could have moved it somewhere else. And he said, no, I'm keeping it here. You know, he wanted the Grizzlies to stay in Memphis. He wanted the Kings to stay in Sacramento. And so, and he did that. That was him who made that happen. He protected those communities. You know, yes, he wanted the Stars to go to a big market. Woj tells a story in that piece that he writes how he was complaining when he saw the final three for the Odin Durant lottery, which was a really big, remember Jackie, that was like, yeah. Oh,
big deal.
You know, yeah. And it was, you know, Seattle, Portland and Atlanta. And Woj told the story about him lamenting, damn it, these small markets. Why can't I get New York? Why can't I get Los Angeles? But yet he still protected the small markets. That's the kind of person he was. He made decisions and viewed things that way. He's really one of a kind. And those press conferences during that lockout, I'll never forget, you know, we're talking about, you know, billions of dollars at stake and all these people's livelihoods, and it's affecting everybody. It's costing millions of dollars a day. And I remember somebody at a press conference saying, well, you know, the union is saying you guys have gone backwards. And he just waved his hand and said, back, schmack. You know, he just had this way about him, Jackie. And I don't know, I'll always sort of remember that attitude as much as anything.
I just, was he fair all the time?
No.
I don't think he was. And I think he knew it. And I think, you know, did he have a little too much power by the end? Yes, I would say it's. But is he the most prolific and successful and dynamic owner in professional sports history? Yes. Unequivocally, yes. I don't think it's even close. And I know football fans may talk about Pete Rozelle, but with all due respect, no. What this man did, to give you an idea, when he took over the NBA in 1984, their retail merchandise was at $44 million. By 2007, it was at over $3 billion. The globalization of the game, the creation of the WNBA, his champion, as you say, small market teams, African Americans, women, all, you know, all these things. I defy anyone to tell me who's matched that kind of output.
I was talking with Tim Bontemps tonight. He said that he feels like he's a top 10 person in the history of the NBA. And you think about that it's a players league. It's maybe the most important. It's maybe the biggest players league of all the major sports. To think that a commissioner could be a top 10 person in the history of the league.
Pretty amazing.
Might not be wrong.
So, you know, it's funny. I asked him once, have you ever, I know you've made mistakes. We all make mistakes. But, like, were you ever caught with your, you know, your pants around your ankles like everybody else in the world? You know, there had to have been a time, you know. And he said, well, this has got to do with your boy, Larry. And this is actually, and I'm not trying to plug my own book, but this is sort of where some of this came from, was he told me the story, and it's in the book, When the Game Was Ours, that it's, you know, 1984, the Lakers are playing the Celtics. The Celtics are up 3-2. Stern somehow ends up in an elevator before the game with a bunch of guys wearing Celtics jerseys with number 33 on them. And he, you know, he starts talking to them. You know, where are you from? And they're looking at him like, we're from Indiana. We're Larry's friends. And Stern said to him, you know, jokingly, hey, man, tell Larry to take it easy on us. We want this series to go 7 games.
All right.
You know, and you remember the story, right? And
no, so, I mean, yes.
Oh, you don't?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the Celtics lose Game 6 and Bird is furious and he's hot. And now think about how competitive Bird is. And he had to sit there and watch Magic win that national championship and then in his rookie year win the NBA championship. And now he finally has a chance. He's won championships too, but he finally has a chance head-to-head to beat Magic. And his friends come in right after the game.
Right, you know, they say Stern wanted you to lose.
And Stern wanted you to lose. And so Larry goes off. And he said, I don't have it word for word, but he's like, they want a seventh game so they can make more money. Well, the commissioner got his wish and – he should never be saying that. And I'm sure he's a man and he won't deny it. But he might have just been kidding. But like, this is my living. Like, I'm trying to win this championship. Well, my God, this is headline news for,
right.
You know, slam Stern. Now, remember, this is Stern's first year as
right.
commissioner. His first
right.
year. And I said, well, what did you do? And he's like, oh, my God, I locked myself in my hotel room and thought, what the hell have I done? You know, and he decided to just, you know, wait and let it play out. And of course, it didn't heard at all that the Celtics won in Game 7. And then all this.
No Twitter. Thank God for no Twitter.
So I think it was sort of all forgotten. But just think how one little moment like that in today's world could turn your reputation upside down before you've even gotten started. So anyway, that was his one example of like, yeah, that was one of the mistakes I made. Because one thing about it was, we have evidence of it in Woj's story and the stories we've just told. He just said what he felt, you know. When we did that story, when we did Basketball Love Story, and we asked him about LeBron and the decision, he's like, I'm taking my talents to South Beach. I mean, come on.
He hated it. Oh, my God, he hated that. Yeah.
But he said it, you know, he said it because he just had a hard time. What is it? My daughter's a speech pathologist. She calls them social fakes. So she works with kids who are on the spectrum with autism, and she's trying to teach them how to say something nice, even if you don't really mean it. So like what they do is they wrapped up gifts for all these kids. They were bad gifts on purpose to teach them. And this one little boy opened up an onion, and he's looking at the onion, and he's saying, no, thank you. And she's like, we're going to try it again. And he opens it up and he says, maybe my mom can use it to cook Christmas dinner, you know? Well, David Stern was never going to say that. He was always going to say, no, thank you. Or maybe not even thank you. Just no, I don't want this onion. It's an onion. I'm not calling it anything else but an onion.
He was one of a kind. Well, Jackie, thank you so much for going down memory lane. And there's going to be a lot of stuff said and written about David over the next few weeks, but nothing will ever, even with all the stories that are about to come, you know, trust me, it's what you don't know that would probably blow your mind. That's what I'd love. I wish he had a secret diary that was about to be released. But.
Well, you know what? I actually had a publisher call me and say, all right, let's get you on with David Stern. You're going to do a book with David Stern. It's going to be a bestseller. And so I called him and he said, I am never doing a book with anyone. And not you either, by the way. And not only that, if you try to do it, I'll never talk to you again, and I'll make sure no one talks to you for the book. So you should just put this idea right out of your head.
Yeah.
There you go.
Too bad. All right. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective. Happy New Year, everybody. Unfortunately, with this sad story, but he left the NBA a much better place than when he found it. So thank you for listening.
That's the truth.